Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. I'm Elizabeth Slattery, Vice President of Practice Groups. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. Now please enjoy today's conversation.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to FedSoc Forums. My name is Cameron Westbrook. I'm a recent graduate at the University of Denver Sturm College of Law. I also serve as the student liaison to the Federalist Society's Energy and Environment Practice Group. As a reminder, all opinions expressed are those of our speakers and not of the Federalist Society, as the Federalist Society takes no positions. Today's program is titled Commandeering for Conservation? Our moderator is Professor Jonathan Adler, Tazewell Taylor, Professor of Law, and William H. Cabell Research Professor at the William & Mary Law School. One note for our audience before we begin, if you have any questions throughout the webinar that pertain to the topic at hand, please submit them through the Zoom's Q&A feature located at the bottom of your screen, not the chat, so that in that sense, we'll be able to access them later in the program. With that note, I'll turn things over to our speakers to start the conversation. Professor Adler, thank you so much for joining us and moderating today's discussion.
Well, great. It's a pleasure to be here to moderate this discussion on whether the application of the Endangered Species Act to state and local governments raises commandeering and other federalism concerns that we or that the courts should be worried about. And I'm joined by two experts who I will introduce in a moment. Just a little bit of background before we start. As if you're here on this program, you probably know that the Endangered Species Act makes it illegal to take an endangered species without an incidental take permit. Take is defined broadly under the Act. To take means to harass, harm, pursue, hunt, shoot, wound, kill, trap, capture, or collect, or attempt to engage in any such conduct. And KETA's definition is harm, which has been interpreted broadly over the years to include habitat modification, which actually kills or injures wildlife. Clearly, this definition applies to actions taken by individuals, corporations, even governmental entities that are directed against individual members of listed species, and has been understood and applied to include conduct that disturbs nesting and breeding and feeding behavior. But a question that has come up repeatedly over the last couple decades is the extent to which this definition can or should apply to state and local governments when they operate regulatory or other programs that may allow or facilitate or permit activities that constitute harm or contribute to harm to listed species. And if so, whether or not constraining state and local governments in this way and or perhaps forcing them to regulate private activity so as to protect endangered species violates the anti-commandeering principle that was articulated in cases like New York versus United States and Prince versus United States. This isn't merely a theoretical question. Courts have wrestled with this, going back to an opinion called Strahan versus Cox in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the First Circuit. Most recently, just this past month, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit heard oral argument in a case called Bear Warriors United versus Secretary of the Florida Department of Environmental Protection. In this case, the Bear Warriors Group, a conservation organization, is suing Florida's Department of Environmental Protection, alleging that its permitting of septic tanks and the like contribute to water pollution that in the aggregate degrades habitat for Florida manatees, and manatees are protected under the Endangered Species Act. A district court entered an injunction against the state prohibiting permitting new septic tanks in the watershed and requiring it to implement various other conservation programs. And to some, this injunction looks like commandeering. It looks like the federal government forcing a state to implement and administer a federal regulatory program or to administer its own regulatory program in line with federal requirements. So the 11th Circuit heard arguments both that the Endangered Species Act doesn't authorize this sort of order, but also that it might violate the anti-commandeering principle. to help us kind of unpack these questions and figure out, I guess, perhaps what the 11th Circuit or other circuits should do, joined by two Endangered Species Act experts, both of whom participated in amicus briefs that were submitted in the Bear Warriors case. First, we're going to hear from Jonathan Wood, who's Vice President of Law and Policy at the Property and Environment Research Center in Bozeman, Montana, and who previously worked as an attorney at the Pacific Legal Foundation, litigating on behalf of landowners and others affected by government regulation. Then we will turn to Professor William Snape III, who is Director of the Program on Environmental and Energy Law at the American University Washington College of Law. And he too has been involved in litigation involving environmental regulation, representing various environmental and conservation organizations, including the Center for Biological Diversity. So, out of the way, I'm going to first turn to Jonathan Wood to kind of give us kind of the brief case about why it is one might think that orders like this district court order violate the anti-commandeering principle. Jonathan?
Well, thank you. Thank you, Jonathan. And thank you to the Federal Society for hosting this discussion. I think for this part of the session, I might have the easy role, though we turn to policy. I think I'm going to get a bit harder. I think the anti-commandeering principle application here is actually pretty straightforward. And it's useful to compare it to the most recent Supreme Court case on the principle, which is NCA versus Murphy, where the Supreme Court essentially articulated the standard as the Constitution was intentionally designed to give the federal government and Congress the authority to regulate individuals directly. And it was a conscious choice not to allow them to regulate states as such, that to the extent the Congress is regulating states and private parties in the same way, so where a state is involved in a commercial market or as a landowner, perhaps that would be okay. But where Congress is essentially trying to co-opt state sovereign authority to get them to regulate in pursuit of federal aims, that is unconstitutional. In that case, Congress wanted to outlaw sports gambling everywhere except for Nevada for political reasons. And states started to object. If we don't want to be in the business of outlawing sports gambling, feds, if you want to do that, do it yourselves. And the Supreme Court said that was right. So here, the basic argument that Bear Warriors has made is that there are a lot of owners of septic tanks in Florida who are contributing a small amount of nitrogen that collectively affects the habitat for manatees, a species that has been improving but still has some habitat quality constraints. And rather than going after those individual owners of septic tanks, who Bear Warriors sort of acknowledged, you probably couldn't show a take on behalf of any one of them because their contributions are so small, it has sued the state and said that you are responsible and that under the ESA, it is a violation for the state itself to fail to regulate sufficiently to prevent harm to the species. What's novel and interesting about this case is that the reason why the state is the target is because it's doing things to help manatees, not because it's doing nothing. Over the last 10 to 15 years, it has been actively working to try to improve water quality, including by regulating septic tanks. And over that time, water quality, they've achieved essentially half of their goal for improving water quality. But they're essentially being penalized because they've done something, but not enough. If they had taken a fully hands-off approach, this sort of theory couldn't have been raised. So there are primarily three arguments or explanations given for the anti-commandeering principle. And I think all of them map on quite well to this scenario. The first is structural separation of powers, that we want Congress regulating individuals, not states themselves. And just in describing the case, you can sort of see how that is implicated here. But the two others are also relevant. One is democratic accountability, that we don't want voters and regulated entities to be confused as to the source of regulatory penalties that are being imposed on them. And if Congress and the federal government are able to channel their regulation through the states, it can be harder for those feeling the consequences of regulation to know who to hold accountable. And we actually see this playing out in Florida itself, where there are currently ongoing lawsuits suing both the federal government and counties over ESA prohibitions that are being put on them because no one can figure out who exactly is in the driver's seat there. And the third is fiscal accountability, that if Congress can impose the enforcement responsibility of its policies onto states. It has no incentive to think about how to enforce or structure its programs to actually be cost-effective and efficient. And that's essentially what you have here in the small harms problem. Congress might need to think creatively about how to deal with those sorts of problems. And under other statutes, it has done that work, but it hasn't under the ESA. And part of the reason might be the expectation that litigants will sue states and force them to do it, and they'll have no choice to offer different approaches or to be concerned about costs. And then the other thing I want to briefly touch on that I think is relevant to this legal question is whether the preemption doctrine might be an out to an otherwise strong anti-commandeering problem. Here in the oral argument for the 11th Circuit, Bear Warriors argued that commandeering is essentially irrelevant, relying on Strahan versus Cox, the 30-year-old case that Jonathan mentioned, and said that instead what we have here is a preemption issue, that states cannot authorize something that federal law prohibits. And so if federal law prohibits take, states cannot issue any permit that would foreseeably result in take. Notably, they're not relying on any statutory text for that argument. There is a preemption provision in the statute, but it's incredibly narrow. And there are quite a few savings clauses in the statute to preserve state authority to the maximum amount. There's also no field preemption argument here. It would be, frankly, absurd to interpret the ESA to preempt all state regulation of any activity that might cause take. There's just no way for the Fish and Wildlife Service to regulate farming, home building, septic tank system, and pervasively regulate all the incredibly broad range of activities that can cause take. And finally, there's really no conflict preemption argument here. It is quite common for the federal government and the states to jointly regulate the same sort of activity for different purposes. And we generally don't hold that a state in regulating has to assume a regulated entity will ignore or violate federal prohibitions as a part of their own permitting strategy. And that's kind of the unstated principle here, is that if the state issues a permit for a septic tank, it can't assume that the septic tank owner will also deal with the federal government to ensure ESA compliance. And then the bow on this is the remedy the court issued here. That I think the commandeering problem comes in the interpretation of the ESA, not just in the remedy, but it is noteworthy that what the court held here when it found that the state had taken manatees and violated the ESA was that the court constructed its own new state policy. The state was required to ban septic tank installation within the watershed that affects the manatee, to implement various conservation programs for the benefit of manatee. And importantly, it couldn't change either of those imposed state policies unless it got the permission of the federal government first. So the state was directed to go get a permit from the Fish and Wildlife Service and get federal approval of any alternative state policy the state might prefer. And that, again, that's straightforward anti-commandeering. There's really no way to distinguish this case from the NCAA versus Murphy sports gambling case.
All righty, thank you, Jonathan. So we've heard the case for why applying the Endangered Species Act in this way should raise commandeering concerns. Bill, I suspect you disagree. So, Bill, why don't you take a moment to explain why you don't think these commandeering arguments should be persuasive to the courts?
Sure. Thank you so much to both the Jonathans. Well, I was going to start with some of the issues I agree with Jonathan Wood on, and I'll just say briefly what those are. I agree, even though we may not agree on the specifics, I agree that there are some very interesting and perhaps serious Endangered Species Act implementation and enforcement issues that are raised by this case, certainly relatively unique from a remedy point of view. But I'm going to argue that they don't even come close to rising to a constitutional issue. I know we live in a world today where favored free market and sort of right-leaning principles seem to be embraced by the current Supreme Court. I get that. That is reality. But I don't think this is one of them. I think even this court could see the difference between their existing 10th Circuit jurisprudence and commandeering decisions versus what is happening here in this manatee case. And let's just look at the two cases that the defendants, the state of Florida, Department of Environmental Protection, that they rely upon. And they were both mentioned. One of them was mentioned by Jonathan Wood just a second ago. First, in the Murphy versus NCAA case, that was an instance where Congress banned the states, told the state legislatures that they are not allowed to authorize sports gambling. Directly told the states they had to stay out of that area. And that was held to be, as Jonathan correctly stated, violative of the commandeering prohibition in the, interpreted in the 10th Amendment. The 11th Circuit case that Jonathan, I know, knows about, I don't think he mentioned it in his opening. If he did, I missed it, but it has been briefed and was a big issue at the 11th Circuit, is the Bourbon case. And there again, Congress, in the context of a federal program, said that the states must issue an ID card for citizens and for individuals so that the federal government could better implement the program that it was at issue here. In both of those instances, the state was being commandeered to either not do something that it had the power to do or to assist the federal government in enforcing a federal standard. That is not what is happening here with the Manatee case. First of all, the Endangered Species Act prohibition against take applies to all entities, individuals, corporations, local governments, state governments, the federal government, federal agencies, state agencies, you name it, you can't take an endangered species. That's well established. No one is disagreeing with that. And so here, the state was found through its actions to be causing a take of manatee. And we'll get into the question and answer, the vicarious liability and causation. I think those are some interesting issues, and I'm certainly ready and willing to talk about them. But from a constitutional point of view, the state has tons of options, lots of options. And in fact, it's funny that we keep talking about this septic tank moratorium because the court was very clear that it was a temporary moratorium, a pause, a timeout, very similar in the Fifth Amendment context to the Lake Tahoe case. If you recall the Lake Tahoe case, where that was held not to be a taking, where the Tahoe regional agency stopped, and this was a Fifth Amendment taking case, but I think it's applicable, stopped for a period of time all new permits so that the local agencies could get a grip on water use and water quality in the area. I think that analogy holds here. And indeed, I find it very interesting that the 11th Circuit in this case, I have no idea how they'll decide. Obviously, it's pending right now, but they certainly have a lot of authority to amend the district court injunction or to change it or to modify it. And I think that's a legitimate issue that ought to be on the table. But that's an Endangered Species Act issue, not a constitutional issue. And in fact, I'm not aware of any Supreme Court case or Court of Appeals case that has held that an action by the government is commandeering when the federal government is seeking simply to enforce its own statute and to enforce what is well known to be applicable to all parties. That's what's going on here in this case. And this is not a new principle. There are cases, it's not just the Strahan v. Cox case. There's a Red Wolf case where a preliminary injunction was granted against the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission for enjoining coyote hunting because it was interfering with red wolf recovery. Similarly, in Center for Biological Diversity v. Little, plaintiffs successfully challenged the state of Idaho's issuance of licenses set to wolf snares due to a reasonable likelihood that it would ensnare threatened grizzly bears. So this is not the first time by any means that states have been held not to be able to violate the Endangered Species Act, that just because they're a state government doesn't mean they're allowed to take actions that take a listed species. That's a no-no and is not allowed. And I guess I'll just finish maybe a little bit early because I think the question and answer may yield a more interesting discussion. I just want to repeat, while Jonathan and I may disagree on exactly what that remedy might be, I want to repeat that there are ample ways under the Endangered Species Act, as a matter of statutory and regulatory law, to craft a remedy here that works for all parties. I think one of the underlying tensions here is, and maybe this will be my last point, is that while the Endangered Species Act does have cooperative federalism provisions in it, most notably under Section 6, but Section 4, there are a lot of provisions that mandate and ensure that the states have a role in the conservation of federally listed species. That cooperative federalism is not like the Clean Water Act and Clean Air Act, where the states essentially get permitting authority under those statutes. The Federal Endangered Species Act, whether you like this fact or not, was passed precisely because, and has been affirmed by Congress because, the states were falling down on their job. They were not protecting species. Species were going extinct, and the federal government, through the Commerce Clause and the Treaty Clause, federalized the protection of those species. I don't believe that's even remotely at issue here. And so if that's the case, then the states must, like all other parties, comply with the Endangered Species Act. And I think here the state, while it did have its own remedy, clearly that was not enough. And I think really this is a constitutional, this is a really a policy issue masquerading as a constitutional issue in my view. So I'll end it there and look forward to some good Q&A.
So what of it, Jonathan? Is this really a policy issue masquerading as a constitutional issue? Do you have thoughts and response? And I guess also, you know, might be worth addressing, you know, if you're right, what does that mean for how the Endangered Species Act is implemented?
Yeah, so it will surprise no one that I disagree. And I think the way I would put it, so what the Supreme Court has said is that the purpose of the anti-commandeering principle and what it does is prohibit Congress from, quote, seeking to control how states regulate private parties. That is absolutely what is happening here. The only reason why Florida is accused and has been found to violate the ESA is that it is not regulating private parties enough to prevent take of threatened species. There's nothing it's doing directly to cause take. And that's why I appreciate the point that Professor Stain makes, that Congress can regulate states the same as they regulate private citizens. So if a state is acting as a commercial actor, as a landowner, or doing things itself that would violate take, so if a state wildlife official goes out and traps an endangered species, the ESA can apply to that the same way it applies to private parties. But there is simply no private analog to the federal government controlling how states regulate activities that can cause harm to endangered species. That is commandeering on its face. This did come up in the oral argument. And essentially what the Bear Warriors attorney argued is that the anti-commandeering doctrine shouldn't be thought of as a substantive constraint on federal power, but instead a drafting convention, that it prohibits Congress from being too explicit in trying to control how states exercise their sovereign authority. But if it does it implicitly or as part of a large enough program, it can do the same thing without raising the same problems. And that totally undermines the purposes behind the anti-commandeering doctrine. So I think saying that because this statute regulates states and private parties, it is okay for it to commandeer doesn't work. And you know, I didn't get the sense of the oral arguments the 11th Circuit judges were buying it, though, as Professor Snape said, I don't want to make predictions on how that court will work. But I think it's really hard to square with Murphy versus NCA and its articulation of the doctrine. On the policy, I think is actually where I think this case gets a lot harder. As I said earlier, a lot of harms to endangered and threatened species are very small, and they are difficult to address through a traditional policing approach. So broad federal prohibition that requires the few hundred federal law enforcement officers within Fish and Wildlife Service to enforce is going to be really difficult when you're talking about thousands of septic tanks for one species, not to mention the millions of farms and home construction, all the other projects affecting the nearly 3,000 listed species. I take that point. I think it's a fair one, but it's not a reason to ignore the constitutional problem, and it's a federal problem, not a state problem. So the onus should be on the federal government to find more effective ways to deal with that problem rather than foisting the costs of solving it onto the state. Like that's what the doctrine exists for. But I also think there's a conservation downside to commandeering here. As I said earlier, the only reason why Florida can plausibly be alleged to violate the take prohibition is because it is regulating to improve water quality. If it took a total hands-off approach, then there would be nothing that bear warriors could assert in the oral argument. And so what you may actually see if commandeering becomes widely accepted in this arena is states putting their hands up and saying, well, if we don't get to decide our own policy, we're just going to be dictated to anyway. We're out of the business. Fish and Wildlife Service, good luck being the comprehensive regulator of every activity that may affect endangered, threatened species. And that would be the worst outcome for species, because there is simply no way the Fish and Wildlife Service could take on all that responsibility. So I'll stop there. I mean, I think there are some other policy things we could get into, but that's the big one for me, is that I think there is a positive conservation policy case here, but there's also a really big negative downside that I don't think we can dismiss.
So Bill, let me turn to you. And I think in that last hypothetical Jonathan brought up, I think there's actually both a legal and a policy question there, right? One is, do you accept the claim that Florida could avoid this problem by simply getting out of the business of permitting septic tanks altogether and simply say, we're not going to regulate them at all, do what you're going to do. And that would presumably be worse for manatees, but would no longer be, as Jonathan would argue, would no longer be a violation of the Endangered Species Act. Is that true? And should we be worried about that? Should we be worried that states as regulators, or states may be less, over time, less willing to regulate in areas if they're going to be directed how to regulate by either the Fish and Wildlife Service or, as may be the case, in by courts in response to citizen suits?
Well, there's a couple questions in there. I mean, I guess Florida could decide not to regulate septic tanks, but that seems to be a pretty bad idea for a number of human health reasons. So, I mean, yeah, they could do that, but that seems to be shooting oneself in the foot. And there would still be liability if the septic tanks were being operated in a way that harms manatees. So at some point, those septic tanks, if indeed they're causing the harm, are going to be in the crosshairs of species protection. But I want to go back. I feel like we're repeating ourselves a little, but I think it's an important point, because as the Chief Justice says, facts matter. And I think Jonathan Wood keeps reciting the facts in a slightly disingenuous way, which is, unlike NCAA or Murphy versus NCAA, and unlike Bourbon, here all the federal government has said is, you got to take a timeout on septic tanks until you figure out how to better protect this species. The state has massive flexibility on how it goes about doing that. There are a lot of different ways in which it can do that, and a lot of ways that likely include authorizing new septic tanks at some point. So just as a matter of fact, this is a temporary moratorium. All the options for the state are on the table. And I just think as a matter of a fact, that's way different than the commandeering cases that we have had so far. As it relates to the state of Florida, I mean, it's a big state, a lot of government officials. You know, I don't want to simplify, you know, it's got a very complex political and regulatory system. But this is not a state at this point that is known, and a governor that is known for its vibrant environmental protection. Need I remind you about the Alligator Alcatraz project, where Florida insisted for over a year that there was no federal involvement, even though clearly there was, and eventually had to back off and realize that the whole project had problems. And so the reason I'm bringing that up is, the Endangered Species Act, especially at the state and local governmental level, is only as good as the state and local governments want it to be. That the state and local governments in red states, generally, it's not always red, but generally, they want to play hardball and they want to be obstinate and they want to fight the Fish and Wildlife Service tooth and nail at every decision. State and local governments can do that. But that's precisely why we have a citizen suit provision, because Congress said and has reaffirmed that if any person, any entity, any government is taking a listed species, private individuals are allowed to sue them in court to stop it. So, you know, if you don't agree that the septic tanks are the proximate cause of the manatee's take, then you can go argue that, and maybe you're right or maybe you're wrong. But again, that's an Endangered Species Act issue. There are all sorts of options for the state to move forward, and they have not been commandeered. They're just being told, stop violating a federal statute.
Just to follow up on that, you said at the beginning that if the Florida backed off and just said, you no longer need a permit for a septic tank, you know, if you create a nuisance or something, maybe we'll come after you, but you no longer need a permit. You agree that would that be a violation of the Endangered Species Act, or is that something Florida can do? And if it would be a violation of the Endangered Species Act, how is it different than Florida never having a septic tank permitting program in the first place?
If Florida wants to get, it's a good question. If Florida wants to get rid of its septic tank program, which of course would have to go through some notice and comment, would go through a process. And I think you would think that the process would include a discussion of what that would mean for compliance with not only the Endangered Species Act, but Clean Water Act and other federal and state laws. I think that we would figure out a way, we being the big WE, we'd figure out a way in which actions that are still harming the manatee could be challenged if they were still harming the manatee. If the state got completely out of the business of approving septic tanks, maybe the state could get out of that. But there would be some entities that were continuing to operate septic tanks, continuing to do actions that harm water quality that take manatees. And at some point, as someone who has watched species conservation efforts over the last 40 years, you know, this is the death by a thousand cuts. That's what the Endangered Species Act is there for, is to provide tools to stop that from happening. And so whether the state was involved or not, there would still be legal leverage and legal liability for those entities that continue to take actions that through proving a proximate cause are harming listed species. That doesn't go away just because the state stops approving septic tanks.
Oh, yeah, sure. No, I was just wondering if it removes the state as a potential defendant.
It might. I don't know why the state would want to do that, but if the state really wants to cut off its nose to spite its face in that way, I think the state could maybe do that.
Yeah, no, I agree with you that as a practical matter, septic tank regulation in Florida is probably not the scenario where that would happen. I wonder if in some of the cases that arise, like suits against states that are allowing certain types of wildlife traps, for example, are those scenarios where states are more likely to say, you know, if you're not going to let us regulate trapping the way we want to, we're just going to get out of the business altogether, and feds, you can take care of it. You know, whether that's a more realistic scenario, you know, is Idaho at some point going to be willing to say, you know, if you don't let us collect these little fees or we're not going to be allowed to collect fees for permitting trapping anyway, we'll just get out of it altogether and permits are no longer required.
I want to answer that specifically because at least in the instance of wildlife control and wildlife services, as you know, the federal government and the state government have a century-long program where they've been killing millions of animals every year, coyotes, badgers, raccoons, you name it. And so hard to imagine the states stopping doing that. And in any event, at some point, if you're going to kill a couple hundred thousand coyotes or whatever you're killing, you're going to need some authorization by a governmental agency to do that. I don't think there's any way for you to avoid that when you're killing that level, even when it's that type of wildlife carnage. So I guess I don't accept that hypothesis because I just don't think it's realistic.
All right, Jonathan, I don't know if you have thoughts on that, but also I'm curious, you know, you mentioned in your comments as initial matter that the anti-commandeering principle applies to regulating states as such. And I was going to ask you to unpack that a little bit because, yeah, a state may regulate water quality by requiring permits for septic systems, but the state or local governments may actually operate sewage treatment facilities that are themselves emitting. They may manage lands that you know, have listed species on them or that you know, contain species habitat as part of land management. They might, especially in the West, you know, perhaps engage in herd management for particular species. Folks that really know the Endangered Species Act might well remember the Palilo litigation, where the concern was the state of Hawaii on Hawaii state lands maintaining a population of, if I recall correctly, feral sheep and goats that fed on plants that were mamani saplings that the Palilo bird relied upon. To what extent do your arguments apply to these contexts where states are doing things that, or state and local governments are doing things that state and local governments often do, but that aren't, you know, pure regulating of private conduct? You know, is that the line, or, you know, how do we understand kind of where the states as such concept is doing the work?
Yeah, so I think that's a great question that I think helps unpack this, that if the Congress is regulating states on in the same way that it regulates private parties, and there is no commandeering problem, because you're not, if Congress isn't essentially trying to co-opt state sovereign authority, they are not acting as sovereigns when they you know, operate, you know, manage land, manage herds, do all these things that private actors do every day. And so as I read the anti-commandeering cases, there is no problem there, at least as far as the Constitution goes. There may be some unique ESA issues where if, say, the, you know, there was one case a couple of years ago where the state of New York owned land on a beach and someone tried to hold it responsible for the effects of feral cats on endangered threatened species, where the state itself wasn't doing anything. It just happened to own the land where this was happening. And there, I think there is a decent ESA question of whether the prohibition against causing harm implies an injunction to prohibit harm that you weren't yourself causing. So there could be some interesting issues in the states as landowners and land managers, but generally, I don't think they will be commandeering. And the two other brief points I want to touch on from Professor Snape's comments. So I think one area where you could see this concern play out of states choosing not to regulate to avoid this problem is wetlands. Post Sackett, most responsibility for regulating wetlands has fallen to the states, and the state approaches vary tremendously. Wetlands also tend to be habitat for endangered and threatened species, a lot of them. I could absolutely see a state saying, well, if our choice is regulate to an extreme degree to fully satisfy the purposes of the ESA or stay out of the business of regulating these kinds of wetlands in the first place, states would choose the latter. In fact, currently, a lot of states are already choosing the latter without that threat hanging over them. And then I also wanted to respond to Professor Snape's sort of flexibility argument that the commandeering idea only applies when Congress says states do this thing specifically, as opposed to states implement this policy, but you may have some choices about how to do that. I think this is totally irrelevant to the anti-commandeering or not a valid way out of the anti-commandeering problem. So if you imagine if you took any of the existing commandeering cases and tweak them slightly so that Congress set up a federal permitting regime for state policy so that states could submit their proposed policies and get federal approval of them, you still have all of the same problems you have in Congress just dictating it in the first place. And that's actually what we have here. I think Professor Snape was a little wrong to suggest that Florida itself has lots of flexibility. Here it has none. It has the opportunity to potentially ask the Fish and Wildlife Service for permission to do something else. Aside from getting out of the business of regulating this area entirely, it has no options to get a VSA liability. The entire discretion is at the federal level.
So, Bill, what of that? Is there really flexibility? And just to sharpen that a little bit, I seem to recall in New York versus United States, Justice O'Connor saying that giving the state a choice of things that the federal government could not simply mandate doesn't escape the commandeering problem, right? That if the federal government can't just simply mandate A or mandate B, saying to the state, do A or B, doesn't solve the problem.
Yeah, and I think what we have here is something far more complex than that. I agree that that's what was said in the New York case. But look at the case, the Reno case in the Supreme Court that was issued a few years later. There, the Supreme Court actually distinguished the New York case, and it said the court upheld the Congress's Driver's Privacy Protection Act of 1994, which required states to obtain individuals' consent before selling their data to private entities. So there, the state had to play pool to comply with the federal statute, but had a lot of different ways in which it could do that. And I don't think it's an option A or an option B. In fact, if we know anything about endangered species protection, Jonathan Adler, because you and I have been doing this a long time, is that very frequently the solutions to a species conservation issue are what is a solution that no side had thought of at the particular time. You know, all sorts of creative solutions arise over time. And so I think with manatees and water quality and growth levels in Florida and coastal protections and boat management in terms of speeds and things like that, there are a lot of different levers that the state and local governments have to make sure that the manatee doesn't slip into extinction. It just so happened that at this point, the temporary moratorium septic tanks seem to make the most sense. I teach property law, and this is not a perfect analogy, but I teach the Mount Laurel cases, which are in most property law textbooks. And for those who don't remember the Mount Laurel cases, that's where the New Jersey Supreme Court said that every locality in New Jersey needed to have some form of inclusionary zoning. And the reason I'm bringing that case up was there were several Supreme Court cases in Mount Laurel, and each time they didn't disagree that there was a sort of discriminatory zoning going on, but they could not agree on the remedy. Remedies are hard sometimes, and I'm not at all convinced that the district court here got it right with remedy. I actually think the 11th Circuit, at the very least, likely is going to play with that remedy. I mean, I think that's very much an issue, but that's an Endangered Species Act implementation issue, because nowhere did the state did the statute or Congress say, forever and ever, state, this is how you must behave. All the agency said here is, we're taking a time out. We need to figure this out. And until we come up with a better solution, we're not going to approve more septic tanks until we have a game plan on how to move forward. That's not option A or B. That's an infinite number of options that the state has to move forward.
So one question I have for both of you is looking at the Endangered Species Act itself, I'm wondering, should we make much of a distinction in this discussion between what Section 9 does and what Section 7 does? So Section 7, which applies only to the federal government, and I think was the basis, or by going to the federal government, says that not only is the federal government is it not allowed to take an endangered species, but it's not allowed to fund, authorize, or carry out activities that are going to jeopardize endangered species or result in the loss of a listed species critical habitat. Does the fact that we have that language as applied to the federal government, and we don't have language prohibiting, authorizing, funding, or carrying out actions by state and local governments, or for that matter, private parties, mean that we shouldn't interpret Section 9 to extend to that? And if we're unsure, should the specter of commandeering concerns, you know, put a thumb on the scales towards interpreting the act in that direction?
Let me answer that first, if you don't mind, real quick, sure. And I'll let Jonathan get as long a rebuttal as he wants. As you recall, Jonathan, Professor Adler, for many years, up until what, like 2011 or 2012, when the Ninth and Tenth Circuit resolved this, it was not at all clear that when you brought a Section 7 consultation claim as a plaintiff, that you needed to prove that there had been a take. Right. And now, if there's going to be an incidental take permit issued through the Section 7 process, the agency must prove a take, just like it would in the Section 9 process. So I think to that reality, to some extent, I think, I'm not sure what the right verb is, but it sort of tempers your question, because at any level, to have any governmental action on species, you need to be able to prove a take. And the only difference between Section 7 as it relates to the federal government and Section 9, which applies to everyone else and not just the federal government, is that with Section 7, when it does involve the federal government, you do get that those added consultation provisions, the biological assessment, the biological opinion, the communication between the agencies. That doesn't need to happen with the state agency, but the state agency still, either through the Section 6 cooperative agreement process or through here the Section 9, Section 10 process, still has to be alleged that it's violating law and taking the species. So I think that answers your question, but there has to be a proven take for a state government to be on the hook. Otherwise, it's very difficult for a private plaintiff to prevail these days. Very difficult.
Jonathan?
I think that answer dodges the point a little bit. Maybe I should have stressed at the beginning. My argument is not that the ESA is unconstitutional under the anti-commandeering doctrine. In our brief, we offered a constitutional avoidance issue, is that the Section 9 simply doesn't reach states' exercise of regulatory authority in the first place. There's nothing explicit that says that. Says that it does. This is purely an interpretive gloss that a few environmental nonprofits have tried to impose through litigation. A few courts have gone along with. And I think to that point, Section 7 is really powerful because it is an explicit control of how federal agencies exercise their regulatory authority. If the take prohibition reached that through the reference to any person, which applies to the federal government the same way that it does to the states, Section 7 is unnecessary and is redundant. The only reason why you need that is because the general take prohibition doesn't reach the exercise of a regulatory authority. You need a separate section for that. And then it's notable that Section 7 doesn't apply to the states. Section 6, the federalism provision, which does apply to the states, is wildly different from Section 7. It largely imposes obligations on the federal government, not the states. So it requires the federal government to cooperate to the maximum extent practicable with states. It gives states that design their own programs to conserve species a unique opportunity to decide what federal policy should be. So federal prohibitions on take don't apply to states that take certain steps under Section 6. And none of those provisions work if you can commandeer the states under Section 10, because they wouldn't have the opportunity in the first place to recover species in ways that don't map onto Section 10's take prohibition or Section 9's take prohibition.
But that's not how Section 6 works, though. Section 6, the federal government doesn't have to agree with those cooperative agreements. They have a threshold at which they'll sign a cooperative agreement. And the only thing Section 7 does is it just simply holds federal agencies to a slightly higher standard in terms of adverse modification of critical habitat and or jeopardy. And those provisions do not apply to the state government. I agree, if those applied to the state government, if there was a Section 7 that applied to the state government, that could perhaps be commandeering. But here, where the state government has violated the law and is being given a menu of options to comply with it, that's not commandeering. I mean, we just keep repeating ourselves, but like these cases are not at all like the Murphy and 11th Circuit cases where the state government had no choice on how to behave and the Supreme Court intervened and said, no, you can't do that. Here, the state government's got lots of options. We've even been talking about them over the last hour. In fact, we've been talking about them. Well, maybe they'll have less options now and they won't want to be cooperative and da-da-da-da-da-da, all of which may be true. But that indicates that the state has a lot of options right now. Whether they politically choose to implement them, I can't speak to that. But as a matter of practicality, everything's on the table.
So I want to remind folks that are on, if you have additional questions for our panelists, put them in the Q&A box. I still have lots of questions. So as we know, the Trump administration has proposed rescinding the harm definition. And as I understand it, the logic behind the proposal is that the only prohibition really is that which is in the text of the Endangered Species Act itself. And I think it's understood that the Trump administration's position is that the text of the act itself should produce an outcome consistent with Justice Scalia's dissent in the Sweet Home case. If the harm definition, the current harm regulation is rescinded, does that make this question go away? That is to say, does if the Trump administration is able to shrink what is understood as constituting harm for under the Endangered Species Act, does this kind of become a moot exercise in terms of worrying about commandeering, because none of these activities would constitute takes of listed species, or would state and local governments still have to be worried about vicarious liability in some of these sorts of circumstances?
I don't know. Do you want to go first on that?
Sure. I'm happy to take that first. And I the answer is it depends, and it would take some time. So this came up in the oral argument where the court was concerned of, are we going to issue an opinion and the next day the rules are going to change and our opinion won't have any effect. And the attorneys couldn't, and so didn't offer any prediction on when that change might finally be finalized, since it's totally up to the federal government. But what the plaintiff said is that if the harm definition is rescinded so that there is no explicit regulation extending the take prohibition to habitat modification that injures wildlife, that they would still argue that it is compelled by the statute's text itself. So they suggested that the case would have to be remanded for further litigation. But this, unless that argument was rejected, this commandeering constitutional avoidance problem wouldn't go away. That the plaintiff at least felt confident they could make the case based on the Sweet Home decision, which is a Chevron case, but there's also a lot of language in there suggesting that, at least for purposes of five of the justices from that court, that maybe the text is pretty strong here.
Bill, your thoughts?
I agree with Jonathan on that. I mean, okay. The issue of the habitat harm was not briefed in the case that was just argued at this Bear Warrior case that was argued at the 11th Circuit. So at the very least, it would have to be remanded. I think there is very strong textual support, and I think Loeb or Bright would support the harm, but we'll see. We'll see where that goes, where the Trump administration goes on. What actually happens in that litigation. But at this point, I don't think that proposal, which is only just that, would have any distinct impact on this case. It could in a few years, perhaps, but not now, and not for at least the next year.
Well, just one thing I would note is that, yes, it's at the proposed stage, but the final is at the OMB for final review. So this may happen in the next few weeks. Like, this isn't necessarily something really far into the future. But I also think there's a practical problem of if the state has to get federal approval of whatever its policy is going to be, and the federal government is saying we won't issue a permit because we don't think the take prohibition applies in the first place, the remedy of the court order becomes much more difficult. Like, the state at that point kind of has no choice because it has no option at the federal level, but the court has said you have to get their permission. And that was briefed in the case. That is one of the unusual puzzles about the way in which the court subjected state policy to federal approval.
And that was argued at the 11th Circuit. And we both have said we don't want to predict what the 11th Circuit did, but hard to think that the 11th Circuit won't tinker with that remedy on some level, but who knows?
So we're getting near to the top of the hour. So I did have a kind of a final question for each of you. And that is, if we look at the Endangered Species Act, it at one level does embody a cooperative federalism model in that it does anticipate state action, but it's a very different cooperative federalism model than we see, say, in the pollution control statutes. If the 11th Circuit, or perhaps if this went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court were to decide that this sort of thing were commandeering, I'm curious whether each of you think the federal agencies, Fish and Wildlife Service, National Marine Fisheries Service, have the ability within the existing Endangered Species Act to try and create incentives or inducements for state cooperation, like we see in the pollution control statutes, or whether or not this is something that would have to be fixed by Congress. That is to say, if the court decides that these cases like Bear Warriors put the courts in position of commandeering state and local governments, is there something that Fish and Wildlife Service can do with its existing legal authority to try and induce greater state cooperation to deal with the many, many little harms that in the aggregate may imperil species survival? Or is this something that's just, is this just yet another question that's going to have to sit in Congress's lap unless and until such time as Congress decides it wants to revisit any of these statutes? And I don't know, whichever one of you wants to grab that one first.
I'm happy to take it first. I think not only would the Fish and Wildlife Service have other tools, it's already using them. So one of the more recent anti-commandeering cases under the ESA had to do with state water law, where Texas was sued saying that because it's the regulator of removing water for river for private use, that it was responsible for downstream effects. And that's in sharp contrast with the way the Fish and Wildlife Service has implemented the ESA when it's involved in water disputes. Here in Montana, not too far from Bozeman where I live, Fish and Wildlife Service worked with the state to develop a candidate conservation agreement with assurances, where through the state, the Fish and Wildlife Service basically permitted all of the small harms that you're talking about, where each individual water user probably doesn't pull out enough water to affect, in that case, the Arctic grayling, but on net they do. And the state voluntarily sought this permit, which would provide a shield to all of the private parties. And because of that voluntariness, you don't have any commandeering issue. And there are examples like that across the board. There are lots of local governments, counties, and states that have been issued ESA permits that they sought for the benefit of private parties who otherwise it would have been either really costly for them to get a permit or enforcement would have been really complicated because of the smallness of the harms. But the other policy point I would mention, so you're focusing on your question focused on what else could the service do? But I think it's equally important to ask what else could the states do? Where you're right that the federalism provision, or cooperative federalism provision in the ESA are different than the Clean Air Act and Clean Water Act, which limit the states to effectively issuing federal permits. The ESA provision says that if a state develops an adequate conservation program for species, the service has to issue a cooperative agreement. It's mandatory. And then federal prohibitions that take only apply in the state to the extent the state adopts it as its own. So states really do have this unique opportunity to shape what federal policy should be, but they can't if they can be commandeered on the front end. If litigation can force them to regulate in certain ways, that flexibility is essentially gone.
Bill, last words to you.
Yeah, well, I finally figured out with Jonathan Wood's last comment where maybe the root of our disagreement lies, which is, I mean, obviously we disagree on the law and commandeering and, you know, how far the 10th Amendment should go, but assumed in his otherwise good recitation is that the Fish and Wildlife Service and National Marine Fisheries Service, the two expert agencies, are always out there vigilantly enforcing the act. That's completely false. If that were true, there would never be citizen suits. And in fact, ultimately, when you take a step back from the Endangered Species Act, there's a big battle going on. And I think Congress knew this was going to be the battle. And we've been talking about it now for over 50 years, which is that the statute on one level says, use the best available science, listing, critical habitat, even consultation to a certain extent, take, all use the best available science. On the same level, though, the agencies are subject to political pressure. The statute itself allows economic considerations at the critical habitat phase, allows other alternatives and options at the consultation phase, allows a lot of flexibility to approve a Section 10 permit. And so this battle, this sort of organized battle between science and politics is sort of how the act is supposed to be implemented in a certain way. And it's not commandeering to hold a state agency to a scientific standard of species take. That's all that's happening here. When the agency takes actions that violates that scientific standard, no politics gets you out of that, at least at this point, gets you out of that quandary. That's not commandeering. That's enforcing a federal statute to everyone. So that's my answer, is that species always tend to be on the losing end of these battles because money talks and bullshit walks a lot of times. And so the fact here that a federal judge and a federal agency actually were standing up for the manatee and forcing the state to take a harder look at whether what they were doing is really working, to me, is a good thing, ultimately. Even though I'm maybe not convinced that the remedy is perfect, I like the fact that we're being asked this hard question, because that's what the Endangered Species Act requests. It requires us to ask that question.
All right, I think that'll be the last word. And Cameron, back to you.
Thank you so much. I just wanted to thank both our panelists for sharing your expertise and opinions on this important issue. And thank you to Professor Adler for moderating. If our audience is interested in learning more about all Federalist Society's programming, please visit their website at fedsoc.org. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thanks for listening to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. To learn more, visit our website, fedsoc.org.